Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to focus on a very, very important subject. We're going to talk about stress, and we're going to talk about natural approaches to the problem of stress. Stress, of course, a ubiquitous problem, probably the single biggest factor that is the common denominator of patients that I see here in New York, and I presume wherever you're listening from. Stress is a big deal. Stress affects our bodies, and we need to arm ourselves with strategies to counteract stress. And today we're going to talk to Dr. Daniel J. Crisafi. He's earned a PhD and a Master of Health degree. He's born and raised in Montreal, and he has studied also in the United States. He is, in addition, a Master Herbalist, and he's obtained a naturopathic degree. So he has both a conventional and mainstream background, as well as a background in natural treatments. He's based in Montreal, and he is the author of a great new book, which is entitled Syndrome S. In addition, he is the author of several other books, and he's writes for medical journals and has edited medical and health journals. And he has been a guest on a variety of radio and television stations across Canada and the U.S. So without further ado, here's Dr. Crisafi. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Thank you. Nice being on.
Okay. So, well, first of all, give us a little background on the term stress. You know, we talk a lot about it. How can we define it?
Mm-hmm. Well, if we base ourselves on research by Dr. Hans Selye, who is considered the world's specialist on stress in the 1970s and 80s, and actually taught at the Université de Montréal and at McGill University in Montreal, stress is the way the body adapts to any kind of change. So we could say that stress is any change that requires mental, physiological, or biochemical adaptations. Stress is anything that requires that the body change what it's used to doing. And that's an important point to bear in mind, because a lot of people, when they think about stress, just think about the negative aspect of stress. So they say, you know, I'm not stressed, which means they're not running around like a chicken that's had their head cut off.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean they're not going through stressful periods. So anything that requires mental, physiological, or biochemical adaptation, whether it's hormonal, chemical, immune, environmental, emotional, or physical. And as an example, you know, menopause is a stress. The body's used to having a certain amount of estrogen, and now that estrogen drops. And the body's estrogen did have a role to play, so the body now has to adapt, it has to change. It has to do differently what estrogen was doing to help to try to maintain a certain situation. That's a stress. Consuming chemicals that your body would react to, pesticides, fungicides, etc., is a stress, in the sense where the body now has to deal with them, it has to eliminate them, it has to neutralize them, chelate them, eliminate them, and so on. Physical stress, exercise is stress. When you exercise, you increase the impact of gravity on muscles and bones, and the body compensates by adapting to it. So stress is anything, again, that requires mental, physiological, or biochemical adaptation.
Now, is stress always bad? You know, everybody says, oh, I'm so stressed, I wish I could be free of stress. Is this a desirable state? Or can stress be, you know, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger?
Well, absolutely. That's exact. I'm going to remember that one. But yes, stress, if it doesn't kill you, will make you stronger. The point is that life is a balance of stressors. We do need stress. Dr. Hans Selye, who I mentioned earlier, talked about this stress, the bad stress, and you stress, the good stress. And we do
that's,
need stress.
That's for our listeners, that would be EU. The letters EU in front of stress, that means like good stress, stress that actually kind of braces you, stimulates you, causes your body to adapt in helpful ways. I guess an example would be like a bodybuilder places intentional stress on his or her muscles, and thereby, you know, if their muscles don't tear or if they're not damaged beyond repair, they rebuild and they get bigger and stronger.
Absolutely, and that's the point. And you're right. Stress can be positive or negative. However, the point is that whether it's positive or negative stress, the body does react to it. And there comes a point where you can have that proverbial drop that makes the bucket overflow, where stress starts to have negative impacts on the body. So you can exercise, which is a good stress, unless you do too much or you do exercise you're not used to. You can change your diet for a healthy diet. That's actually a stress. It's a good stress. But, you know, your body has to adapt to that. And you think about it, people who are smoking and stop smoking are stressed and sometimes stressing during the process. But it's a good stress. The body still has to adapt to the fact that they don't get that amount of nicotine, has gotten used to it, and now you're cutting it out and on and on and on. So, yes, stresses are good. Some stresses are good. and we do need those stressors. Life cannot exist without stress. However, we have to realize that even the good stressors, along with the bad stressors especially, do damage the body or lead to reactions in the body, and those can long-term lead to symptoms associated with stress.
And so what are some of the consequences of unremitting stress that's not properly dealt with by the body's coping mechanisms?
Well, when there's a stress, again, whether it's good stress or bad stress, whether it's emotional, hormonal, chemical, etc., the body will prepare itself to fight or flee. And in so doing, it's going to do two things. It's going to increase any activity that helps fight or flight, and it's going to reduce any activity that is detrimental to fight or flight. So in increasing activities or functions that are useful for fight or flight, it's going to increase blood sugar. It will increase insulin resistance. It will increase blood pressure. It will increase muscle tension, which would all be really useful if you had to fight or flee. It will also decrease any function or any biochemical activity that would be detrimental if you had to fight or flee. So it's going to reduce serotonin, reduce reproductive hormones, reduce growth or repair, and so on. And serotonin is a good case in point, because we do know, we're doing research at McGill University, Montreal. I'm doing research. I'm in charge of research right there, project on the impact of stress. We realize that serotonin drops as stress hormone increases. Now, it's a good thing, actually, because if there was a real danger, it would be a good thing not to sleep deeply, and serotonin helps to sleep. So if you're in a village and you're surrounded by an enemy, it's a good thing not to sleep too deeply so you can hear the enemy if they break through the gates of the village. However, as serotonin drops, a lot of symptoms can develop. Serotonin helps to reduce anxiety. So a drop of serotonin can lead to anxiety, it can lead to depression, insomnia. Serotonin controls appetite, so it could lead to excess appetite. Gastrointestinal symptoms, we now know that about 70%, 80% of all the serotonin in the body is produced in the gut, in the intestinal tract, and that can lead to gastrointestinal symptoms and even to increased perception of pain. So somebody can have a lot of stress. Your body doesn't know you can't fight or flee. It lowers serotonin because it thinks it doesn't want to sleep deeply, but as it lowers serotonin, you start developing symptoms like anxiety, like depression, like insomnia, increased perception of pain, and so on, that in many cases we don't associate. We know the stress causes them, but we don't really associate how it causes them and what to do about them. So that high blood pressure, high cholesterol, high blood sugar, because the body's preparing itself to fight or flee. So all those symptoms can be associated with stress response or with the body starting to overreact to stress.
Is it fair to say that one aspect of stress is mediated by our body's own production of cortisol, which in conventional medicine, the copycat drug is prednisone, and we know that people who constantly take prednisone or are overexposed to it, they have all kinds of devastating side effects. They have diabetes, they gain weight, they lose muscle, they lose bone, they are prey to ulcers, and you know they often have insomnia, psychological problems, even sometimes psychosis from high doses of prednisone. So is that a useful model for understanding the effects of low-dose cortisol excess in the body?
It is, and you can't see me smiling, but I'm smiling because only somebody who's doing a lot of clinical work, as you are, would realize that. But yes, Cortisol is a stress hormone, and we've copied cortisol, we produce cortisone. And when you look at all the symptoms associated with cortisone, whether, again, it's type 2 diabetes, whether it is osteoporosis, whether it's a reduced repair of tissues, or all symptoms of excess cortisol, the stress hormone response. So if you want to know part of what excess stress hormone, cortisol, would do, you can look at symptoms associated with cortisone as a drug, and you get a really good picture of what takes place, definitely.
Right, which is, you know, has a beneficial effect. I mean, it helps to quell inflammation and reduce allergies. So you need some of that stress response. But when the stress response, I guess, gets stuck and is in overdrive, then you have all the negative consequences of stress.
The other point, too, is when there's too much cortisol being produced, the stress hormone, your cells start becoming resistant to cortisol.
Hmm.
So it doesn't have that anti-inflammatory effect anymore. It can start leading to inflammatory problems, for example, to increased allergic reactions. It can start leading to increased inflammatory processes. And some research even shows that it can play a role in exacerbated immune reactions like autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis and so on.
Do you subscribe to the theory, I guess that comes out of Hanselli, of adrenal burnout? You know, there's a certain point where, you know, your body is striving to adapt to stress, and it does a pretty good job. But at a certain point, you kind of cross the Rubicon. You get to a point where your body can no longer crank out enough stress hormones to deal with these insults.
Absolutely. The long-term effect of that, the extreme effect of that, is what we call a burnout. But even before that, you know, you probably know and have patients, and I certainly have a lot of patients like that, who will function if there's a stress. So they wake up in the morning, they've got to go to work, they kick themselves in the rear, not physically, but at least psychologically, and they get the stuff done. And around 5 or 6 o'clock at night, the work is finished, their energy level drops. They go on vacation, they have no energy. So their adrenal glands are a little bit like a horse that's very, very tired. It's not burned out yet, but it's very tired, and it only works if you whip it. And if you don't, it doesn't work effectively. Then you've got indeed those whose adrenal glands really, really don't adapt very effectively, and those are the individuals who go through burnout and so on.
Now, you state in your book that for some reason women are particularly susceptible to stress and its consequences. So what's up with that?
Well, you know, first of all, we have to bear in mind that women are not psychologically inferior to men. In many cases, they're probably a little stronger than we are psychologically.
They live longer, on average.
They live longer, but you know, if you look at what they can handle, which men normally wouldn't handle, they're pretty good. The problem with women is at least threefold. Number one, estrogen production. Estrogen is a stimulant of muscles and nerves. It's a stimulant of the central nervous system. So every month, as estrogen goes up, your body wants to increase the thickness of your endometrium to prepare the uterus. If the ovum is fertilized, if the egg is fertilized, it is a major, major, major change in the body's capacity to adapt to stress. And it increases stressability. Number two, women produce something called progesterone, which is the antagonist of estrogen. Progesterone is kind of the feel-good hormone, and estrogen would be the I'm overreactive hormone if I have too much, trigger-happy, emotional ability, etc. And so we know that if cortisol, the stress hormone, goes up, progesterone drops. Men don't have that issue. We don't have that type of hormone. We've got other problems, but we don't have that type of hormone, so we don't have that effect. And in women, estrogen may be normal, but if progesterone drops, because the body needs the material it makes progesterone with to make cortisol, the stress hormone, so it will want to make more cortisol if it thinks it's a danger.
So you're saying that estrogen may remain stable, but progesterone may start to drop before estrogen, and therefore there's an imbalance.
Absolutely, and in many, many, many cases, we see symptoms of what's called estrogen dominance, too much estrogen. But the estrogen levels in blood tests are normal. It's the progesterone that's too low. So that's another issue. The third is
That triggers a thought because, I've made the observation that we often see women who are in very stressful roles. They're very proficient. They get great grades. They get great jobs. But sometimes, they find themselves in their 30s and 40s dealing with infertility prematurely, dealing with, sleep problems and anxiety problems, weight gain problems. Bloating is a common complaint. And so the symptoms are like the symptoms of estrogen dominance. They can be related to unremitting stress.
Yes. And in this case, again, when they do blood tests, estrogen is normal. The problem is progesterone is low.
Mm-hmm.
And the progesterone and the estrogen may be normal within their scale, but progesterone be lower in relationship to estrogen in the
mm-hmm.
blood test.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, you're absolutely right. And, the other thing, again, is magnesium. Magnesium is probably one of the most important nutrients when it comes to stress and
yes.
stress adaptation. And women do need more magnesium than men because one of the roles of magnesium in the body is to produce the enzymes that break down estrogen.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
So women do need more of the more of magnesium. And if you look at the symptoms, even published in textbooks by the American Pharmaceutical Association, of magnesium deficiency, they include PMS, or premenstrual symptoms, restlessness, osteoporosis. They include anxiety, insomnia, which are symptoms that are greater in many cases in women than in men.
Yeah, interesting. I hadn't heard it put together that way, but clearly, stress, high levels of cortisol, and high levels of adrenaline cause a net outflow of magnesium from the kidneys. Right, the body leaks magnesium under stressful circumstances. Correct.
Absolutely. What we're doing at McGill University, we're showing that when individuals are under higher stress, everything else being equal, there's a significant loss of magnesium in the urine, which means the body's using it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've actually heard that a tip from agriculture, agribusiness, is that, this isn't for animal lovers, cover your ears. When pigs are transported to the slaughterhouse, there's a high mortality. They freak out because it's almost like they get a premonition of what's coming. And many die in transit. But one of the strategies used is to supplement them with magnesium because it actually helps them withstand the effects of that stress.
Well, I've not heard that, but I wouldn't be surprised, and it would do that. Magnesium does reduce restlessness and anxiety and insomnia associated with stress, definitely.
Interesting. Well, clearly serious magnesium deficiency can result in cardiac arrhythmias and sudden death, and it's a big problem with patients who are at risk of heart trouble.
It is, and as a matter of fact, you've seen in the past a few years ago where the research was suggesting the very, 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 very high calcium supplementation in when there's not enough magnesium can actually also lead to cardiac arrest and overreaction, overactivity of the cardiac muscle. And that's because magnesium is a relaxant of muscles and nerves. Mm-hmm. Calcium is a stimulant of muscles and nerves. So you do need that magnesium to relax the cardiac muscles. And one text by the American Pharmaceutical Association even says that magnesium is a nutritional superstar when it comes to cardiovascular disease. So it's not nothing. And yes, it's depleted a lot during stress. It's probably the most depleted nutrient. So that can explain some of the effects of stress on cardiovascular function.
In your book, you mentioned that anxiety or even panic attacks can be physical or chemical and not psychological or simply emotional. Can you explain how that takes place?
Sure. If you speak to somebody who gets panic attacks, for example, or anxiety attacks, some of them will say, oh, yes, I get them, but I've been told by my psychologist or whatever that I can control them. What I have to do is whatever, pull on my earlobe or breathe in a certain way or whatever method they've been told. The point here is if you're getting an anxiety attack or a panic attack, and you know what you're going through is not normal, when you're going through it, when there's that dichotomy, it's not psychological. The person who thinks they're Napoleon doesn't at the same time tell themselves, I should take this stupid hat off my head and I should take my hand out of my shirt. They go through it, and maybe after the fact, they'll be told how stupidly they reacted, and they will say, oh, yes, that's true. But when they're going through it, they don't realize it's abnormal. So when people are going through symptoms that are quote-unquote psychological, anxiety, panic attacks, even depression, and they know it's not normal, when they're doing it, and they're trying to control, they may not be able to control it, but they're trying to control it, which means they know it's abnormal, then it's not psychological. If the psyche was affected, then you wouldn't realize that your behavioral process is abnormal. You would only realize after the fact when you're out of it. So if you realize it's abnormal and you try to correct it or control it, even if you can't, that does show that it's not psychological. And if your body's increasing cortisol, stress hormone, the message sent to the brain is there's a danger. Find a solution. Get out of there. So, of course, your body will mobilize itself. The heart will beat more rapidly. The muscles become more tense. Your lungs will react very, very differently, taking a lot of oxygen. And the message to the brain is get out of there. Of course, you're going to be wired to fight or flee, but if it's not psychological, you'll also know that the way you're reacting is not normal, and that wouldn't be the case if it was psychological.
Well, yeah, so I guess that might explain why people are more prone to these episodes, say, if they have low blood sugar, or if they are deficient in magnesium, or if they have chemical insults, or if it's a certain time of the month where progesterone plummets. I mean, these are some of the myriad of factors that influence your brain, and then the thoughts may accompany the feeling, and you start to experience fear.
Absolutely. Your brain needs glucose to function, so if you're going to hypoglycemia, then it doesn't function as well as it should. Inversely, if your adrenal glands are tired, the stress glands, one of their roles normally is to produce cortisol to increase blood sugar to maintain it. They're not reacting as quickly, and then you can go into hypoglycemia. Absolutely.
Okay, so we've pretty much laid the groundwork for a better understanding of stress. We generally divide these podcasts into two parts. So what I'd like to do in part two, holiday season is beginning here in New York. We're already seeing, it's not even Halloween yet, but we're seeing the Christmas decorations go up, and it's colder, certainly up by you, Montreal, it's even colder, and it's a stressful season. People are rushing about, they're adapting to the arduous challenges of winter and shopping and holidays and sometimes a little dietary excess as the parties begin ramping up. So in part two, I'd like to discuss tangible strategies for dealing with stress, particularly as the holiday season approaches. Our guest is Dr. Daniel Crisafi. He's a naturopathic consultant in Montreal, author of many books. And his latest book we're talking about is Syndrome S. And by the way, for those of you listening to part one, if you're not going to listen to part two, I want to apprise you of an offer. There's a special offer for listeners. Is that correct, Dr. Crisafi? They can call a number and obtain a copy of your book?
Absolutely. For Intelligent Medicine listeners, they can definitely call a number, 1-800-421-2998. If they're calling outside of office hours, leave their name, phone number, their address, and they will get a free copy of the book.
Okay, let's repeat the number. It's 800-421-2998 for a free copy of Dr. Crisafi's book, Syndrome S. And Dr. Crisafi, I hope you know what you're letting yourself in for. Get ready for a deluge, because our listeners' favorite four-letter word that starts with an F is free, F-R-E-E. Okay, so we'll proceed to part two. In part two, we'll talk about specific strategies for coping with stress. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.